I've seen it on YouTube and it's amazing, but you never think that you can get involved because I can't do those sorts of flips. But it's great fun and it's good exercise, and you learn about your body and the environment that you live in.
Anyone can do it.
Welcome everybody to the Sunday Roast, and welcome to a brand new guest, Jimmy. Jimmy the Giant. Hello. Please, can you introduce yourself to our guests?
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Jimmy the Giant. I run a little YouTube page, and yeah, I'm here to chat.
Hi, I'm Big Match Studios. You might have seen me on this channel before, or on my personal channel. I cover news and other boring stuff, and covering Starmer a lot, or as I like to call him, Sir Sleaze a lot. And of course, we've got Alex.
Hi, everyone. My name's Alex, also known as Political X. I'm a journalist, historian, and YouTuber as well. Right, Jimmy, tell us a little bit about yourself. How do you go from parkour to subculture to getting more and more into politics? And
it's such a really random, I guess. Yeah, it sounds like it doesn't have any connection, but it does, because I started in doing parkour videos mainly from always loving YouTube and stuff like that, and wanting to just have a YouTube channel. So I used to run a little parkour brand and stuff, and we wanted to be, you know, YouTube dudes, but we sucked and we failed. That's a lie. My boys were sick. I sucked. And so I was always more like into the video side. And when that brand ended, I was sort of finding like skateboarding documentaries on YouTube. I was like, this is cool. And no one's doing it for parkour. So I was like, fuck it. I had a cool story. Just something I knew. It was about this famous guy who like kind of scammed the parkour world. So I made this video. It was a video essay. And I had no background in like making documentaries or journalism or anything like that. But the making of that documentary just was the format I kind of created for the channel. It was like documentaries on little niche topics in parkour. And they did strangely well. Like some of them would get millions of views and stuff. And so I kept building that. And at some point, I guess I sort of became known in parkour. And it was crazy. Like I sort of knew all the people that I was a fan of, and I was like friends with them and making occasional videos with them, making documentaries on some of these guys, going to like these big events, and it was really cool. But at some point you kind of get like, you run out of steam with telling the same story a million times in different slightly different ways. So I got to this point, and I'd seen a few other YouTube channels where they got into a niche and got stuck in a niche, and I was really desperate not to do that, because at the end of the day I wanted to be a YouTuber more than I wanted to be like a parkour specific person. And I sort of thought, well, how could I pivot out of just parkour? So I started doing different extreme sports documentaries on that, and then from there I got to a point where I was at the same sort of thing that might have gave me, so maybe the parkour thing was a year, the extreme sports thing was about a year, then I got to the end of that and I was like kind of similar feeling, I'm like kind of running out of ideas, or like not as interested in telling the same story over and over again. And so then I was like, what about subcultures? And I made one video, which was the Chav video, and I was like, it's kind of like the videos I've made talking about certain, like I did one on rollerblading, like why rollerblading died, and I was like, well, that's kind of a similar story, like why did Chavs disappear? And so I did that one, and then that like just sent me down a different rabbit hole. Yeah, completely. Like it's just, yeah,
subcultures.
Yeah, and subcultures, because it tells the story, like, you know what it was, I don't know whether just to waffle right now.
Maybe it's fine. Yeah, this is what you're here for.
So yeah, I get it. It's so weird. Sort of, this is allowed for me to just indulge myself. But yeah, so I did a video on Chavs, right? And so I'll be honest, I was quite like just pretty vanilla right winger, you know, like a kind of like a Jordan Peterson listener. Anti-social justice, where anti-woke sort of thing, and I was like, I was in that kind of ilk politically, and it was not really from any like deeply understood reason or whatever. It was just I kind of didn't like woke stuff. That was pretty much it. And I realized that my politics kind of got shaped by these, what I would now consider like grifters, and I started making videos on these topics, like say Chavs. And my perspective of a Chav would have been, this is someone who just, I don't know, they're just bad people. They're just kind of bad people, and like they do bad things. And I wouldn't have thought of it much deeper than that. I was like, maybe they listen to this music and the music like promotes bad things, blah, 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 blah. So sort of like a cultural argument toward why Chavs existed. But when I made the video, I'm like, an honest person, so I'm gonna look for the answers of it. I just never really challenged this sort of perspective that I have. And so I started like looking into the Chav, like the origin of the Chav and where it came from. And I started like halfway through, I started feeling like a bit sympathetic. I was like, man, I know Chavs are like bad. They did bad stuff. They were like gangs and knife crimes, all this sort of stuff. But I started to like get this feeling of like, well, it's kind of their product of their environment. And I remember in that video, I was like quoting Owen Jones. And oh, I remember even saying it in the video where I was like, I don't like Owen Jones much. Because again, bear in mind, I'm like, you know, kind of right winger sort of thing at that time. I'm like, I don't like Owen Jones, but what he said about Chavs is really good and you should probably listen to it. So I said it in the video. And from that point on, I just noticed that my whole attitude, once I started to delve deeply into weird topics about different subcultures, why they rise in certain periods of time when like inequality is high and like why some people are violent, the role of like capitalism in creating sort of, yeah, subculture underclasses. And I started noticing that. And then slowly, like I'm doing more topics on like social housing. So I look into like, I learn about the post-war consensus and all this stuff. And it's like, it just completely, to cut a long story short, it completely just changed my views on everything. And I realized the more information I had, the deeper I understood it.
Oh, wow. So Marina Perkis, I don't know if you're aware of her. She was the same. She used to read, I think, the Daily Mail and a few other things. Complete convert. When she started digging into the detail and looking at the structure and the systemic problems that apply in the UK. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting as well, like, because you've obviously had this approach, and I wonder, there's an element of within education about whether or not education has an effect on people's attitudes. And the Conservatives seem to be hell-bent on making sure people don't get a university education. And it's almost like you're deep diving into these topics and starting to learn about the history or the social problems or the solutions to those problems. And it starts to open your eyes up a little bit. I mean, would that be something fair to say?
Mate,
that, you know, the more you delved in, the bigger the education you gave yourself.
Yeah. So, okay. Think of what my perspective is on that at the time, at the beginning. Mm. I'm, again, a Jordan Peterson-ite. I see academia as woke and like it's all infiltrated by these Marxists and all this sort of shit. And then I read it. That's what Jordan Peterson's telling me about it. And then I read it firsthand myself and I'm like, I don't know how you can read all this stuff and come to the conclusions that you seem to have. Like, it kind of blew my mind. The more I knew about it, the more I realized maybe the reason that academic people tend to be a little bit more left-wing is just because they have more knowledge on this. You know, I know that's obviously coming from my perspective, but it's just, I think the more you learn about it, it's sort of hard not to see how power structures have played throughout history. Mm. And also when you kind of break down the idea that neoliberal capitalism isn't inevitable. It was a changing political ideology, but it's sort of portrayed nowadays as it's like the natural order. So once you realize there was a period of time when neoliberalism wasn't the natural, like, wasn't the thing in question, like wasn't the system we were using, there were different systems. And those had better results when it came to, I guess, like crime and murder and all these things. They had sort of better results for that. When I think of like the post-war sort of Keynesianism and stuff. And then you start to question, well, is this the natural order? And you start to realize that maybe these academics are maybe smart. Who would have guessed that?
Reading's good.
Yeah,
he's a doctor as well. He's got a bloody PhD, isn't he? And he's like, no, academics suck. And you're like, bro, that's you. That's prominent. It's literally you. You're an academic.
Yeah.
Have you read his 12 Rules book? Madge.
Yeah, you know what it was? I mainly listened. Oh, sorry, Madge, go on.
Oh, no, I ain't read anything like that. I was just going to say, with your point on neoliberalism as well, like the most important thing ideology can do is kind of hide itself. So, like you were saying, it's the prevalent structure. That's one of the things my old teacher told me as well, where because it's so like embedded in, it kind of, you don't question it as much because it's just part of your life. And when you question it, people are like, you're the weirdo. It's kind of like I watched this film called Europa Europa, and basically, to push kind of Stalin being, you know, the leader and kind of a god figure, what they did was they said to the kid, he's religious, he was Jewish, he said, ask your god for sweets, and then he got nothing. And then they asked the other kid, ask Stalin for sweets, and then sweets fell down from the ceiling. And that's what I mean, it embeds itself, because then they think he's the leader, you know, he's god effectively. And that's how like that kind of stuff beds in, because you don't question it.
Do you want to hear a messed up fact about Stalin?
Don't be besmirching my boy, young bank robber Stalin. Have you seen, throw up a picture of young Stalin, the bank robber. I'm like, what happened to you, Gry? You went from looking like Sergio Ramos to looking like Wario.
What, was he a looker?
Young Stalin, I'm telling you. Yeah. He looked as handsome as Sergio Ramos. Prime Sergio Ramos. And then when he grew up, he looked like Wario. And I'm like, what happened to you, dude?
Wario.
He looks like Wario.
Young Stalin, you know.
I'm telling you, young Stalin was the guy, fam. Stealing robbing banks and robbing women's hearts, fam. He's taking them Russian women's hearts, fam. His hands are... I was like, what happened to you, bro?
If you're getting everything, then you have to just take it all. Like, he just took it too far.
Oh, God, yeah. He went right down the rabbit hole. And there's evidence to show that he knew it, which is also quite twisted.
Really?
Yeah. So the one really horrible fact that I read was he used to get people writing into him, asking for him to save the people that he's killing. Because you were saying about the God thing. He was like, literally, he would be given a list of people and he just...
Yeah.
Scratch it off all day long. And then there'll people be a random write into name. Him.
Yeah.
There'll be a random name and he's just left it for some reason. There's no reason or rhyme why he's actually left that person off the list. But that's how he operated. But the one of the things that we heard was one of the directors did a film for Stalin about taking Berlin. And at the end of the movie, plane comes in and Stalin gets off the plane and he comes in as like the glorious leader and taking Berlin and being there at the front and everything else, which is complete hogwash. At the premiere, it's claimed by the director that Stalin knew that was complete hogwash, but the rest of the crowd seemed to be banging on about how great it was.
Damn, so basically he was a vibes boy. He just liked the buzz of the crowd.
My favorite Stalin fact, before we turn this into the Sunday Stalin special, is that what he would do is when he would off people, like Russian like figures and stuff, he would get all the, you know, all the books and he'd get all the kids to rip out the page that those people are in. And it's like the original Photoshop, because then they're never there.
God damn.
It's mental. It's mental. The other thing is, someone, I think, Photoshopped a picture of David Cameron into one of the old Stalin pictures. And I looked at it and I was like, is that David Cameron? I was like, what's going on here? And so I had to double take. And then the whole politics class was like, there's something wrong with this picture. And we figured out someone had Photoshopped Cameron in there.
You're attentive to see that, though. I would not see that.
It was just so funny, because this is when Cameron was like at his peak, like 2012 or 13 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what is going on here? Like, it's so dumb.
Yeah, wild times. We wanted to kick off with a video that you've just done, Jimmy, which is on knife crime.
Yeah, fun one.
And obviously in the news this week, zombie knives are being banned and pursued by the police. What's your thoughts on knife crime and how?
But what about all the good guys with zombie knives?
Are they good guys?
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a zombie knife is a good guy with a zombie knife.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
the classic Second Amendment thing, isn't it? If I had a gun, I'd be able to take out the shooter really quickly.
That's really where we're going wrong.
Yeah, you got to be quick on the draw. You know, that's the problem. The good guys are slow on the draw. Yeah, and they lose.
Yeah, basically, that's my proposal, is that we all carry knives, because then we're all safe. I think that seems the logical solution. Yeah, no, it was a rabbit hole of a video, because I read this really interesting. I was so glad I found it. I read this whole like paper. It was called Policing the Crisis in the 20th Century. So effectively, there was this old paper. I don't know if it was a paper, maybe it was a book written called Policing the Crisis. And it was like in the 70s. And it was a similar topic. And I can't remember if it was, I think it was about race. I think it was. And then this is like, it was sort of talking about how it was about mugging. So the term mugging was this sort of just ethereal term that never had like a direct definition. And so the police didn't use it. Like, they didn't have a recorded crime, which was mugging. The newspapers just started to report this new crime, this new phenomena, supposedly, which they called mugging. And it turned out like probably there wasn't a rise in this crime and probably it had already been happening. But when they gave it that sexy title, where it was mugging, it like really got the boys going, and they were like, it was on the newspapers. And so Police in the Crisis, the paper I read, it's by, I think her name was Elaine Williams. And it was about it in the new era, like now. And like, it was called, it was knife crime youths. That was the term. It was like knife crime youths. And that was all over the newspapers. And it was only really popping up on the newspapers from like 2003 onward. Beforehand, people just didn't really, like, they never really put their finger on what it was. Like, it was just murder. Like that no one really, but the media and the newspapers started to keep saying knife crime use, and it became like a moral panic. And so reading that whole, like that piece, it was so good. It was really informative over as it made, like originally I wanted to go in more down the angle of like the race stuff and show how it was like really mischaracterizing. Because I always see it where people are like saying it's multiculturalism and all this sort of stuff. And so I wanted to go down that. But then when I found that, it made me question. I sort of made a joke in the video about Jordan Peterson. I was like, what even is knife crime? Because it didn't even seem like it truly was this new phenomenon, like proportionate to all murders that were happening ever. It was hard to even say, was it this new rising crime? Like that, it sort of actually attacked the core claim, which was that knife crime even is this particular thing. Like it's always existed, was kind of what they were alluding to, or probably it's always existed. But yeah, it was a really interesting video to make, and I'm so glad because I've started to be able to use these videos to educate myself on these topics where I know I'm probably victim to like reading misinformation and just taking that in as like a core belief. And then when you find the evidence that sort of breaks that, breaks it, it's really helpful. And yeah, a lot of looking into the sort of Glasgow stuff about how Glasgow managed to become less, have less knife crime as multiculturalism increased there. That was like a really good counter argument. Yeah.
Do you live in London?
I live outside of London, just like 40 minutes north of London. Yeah. One of them shitty new towns. Yeah. Milton Keynes. I don't know why I'm hiding it.
Oh, okay. I was going to guess that. I'm not that far from there, to be fair.
To be fair, I quite like the snowboarding that you can do there if you go onto the slopes.
I'm in Northampton, so I'm not that far from. Because you said crappy new town. I was like, that's Milton Keynes.
That's
Milton Keynes.
Like, have any of you guys actually witnessed anything in terms of knife crime in front of you, or muggings, or anything like that? Like, because we're all based in different parts of the country.
I have.
I'm based in London. You have.
Yeah, and this is what it's kind of. I was in the center. And yeah, I see this guy, they're having like this fight and they're literally in front of my car. Maybe really baiting myself now, it's fine. There's no way they could work this out. But anyway, they're in front of my car and they're like pushing each other around. This guy just pulls out this fucking swami. Like it was massive. It was like a full on sword. And yeah, I like drive away, obviously. And I'm like kind of looking at it out the window, and then we stop and then we're watching it. And he didn't use it. He was like threatening him with it. It was insane. I couldn't fucking believe it. I'm like, my wife had just moved over to the country and she'd been going through this whole thing of realizing that England isn't how it's sold to people who lived in Eastern Europe. You know, like it's not how they sold it. And so she's come in and sees that. She also saw another situation, a different town of a similar exact scenario. So yeah, it is wild. Like it doesn't make you feel good, to be honest.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. It's pretty freaky. You as well, man? Have you seen anything?
I haven't seen anything, but I know my cousin, he's about 16, so it would have been when he was about 14, 15, some kid got stabbed at his school over like a fight, and it was like the kid who did the stabbing as well was like, I think like 11. You know, he lost the street fight, and then it was like, oh, you got to go stab him or whatever, and you're just like, bro, what are you doing? Jesus. It's absolutely nuts, bro, honestly. It's so bad. Yeah. When he told me that, I was just like, it's just gone, isn't it?
So
I think it's always been. So I worked in a college in central London in a pretty rough neighborhood at the time, which was just absolutely wild in terms of two things. We had the issues with postcodes. So I coached football and basketball. We used to have kids go, can't go in that neighborhood. We're like, why? And they're like, postcode. And that was in the last year of Labour. So that's been kicking around in London for that period of time, and no one's really dealt with it. The college that I worked in also had a games room, which sounds a bit, you know, excessive for a school to have. And it had a couple of PlayStations, table football, ping pong, couple of TVs, sitting area. However, we found out from the stats, and it comes back to your video, Jimmy. We found out from the stats and Glasgow, if we closed that room, violence went up in the school straight away.
How crazy
is that? It's like, yo, we'll settle this on Street Fighter. It's like, nah, Street Fighter's closed for today. It's like, I'm going to see you in the playground.
Yeah, exactly.
We always thought it was just like a minor thing. Like maybe one or two of the kids had it. Because obviously they're not relaying this too much to the teachers. You got whiffs of it every so often.
Damn, that's so odd.
And one of the wildest things happened where I turned up one morning and they put metal detectors in, and they managed to confiscate, I think, 50 to 60 knives coming into the school. Yeah. The worst thing was, you know, you were with these kids a lot. You know, some of them were really academic. Some of them had a lot of street smarts. Some of them had both. But it was wild that some of them thought that you could get through the metal detector without getting caught, instead of just bunging the knife around the corner in a bin or something. They chanced it, and you're like, were you that? Like, that said something about the IQ. I hate to say it, because it feels brutal. But also, it could also say something about the fact that they were so scared of being without it.
Yeah.
That they were willing to chance it.
Do you know, Jermaine Janus did a video, a documentary. Oh, he's been cancelled now.
Do we talk about him?
He's cancelled, but this is not relevant to his cancellation. He went to Nottingham, and he was asking one guy, I think he had a knife about like that big, you know, a zombie killer, ZK, that's what they call him. I think it was one of those. And he goes, why do you carry that? He goes, I carry it for protection, because if I don't have it, someone's going to stab me with it.
Yeah.
And there was like a video in a takeaway where some guys tried to pull up and, you know, stab a dude, and he pulled out his knife, and basically there was no stabbing. And that's why they carry him around, I think, a lot of them, because it's for protection.
One of the things I touched on in the video was like how the bit about gentrification. So it was like these things arguably have probably maybe like there is definitely, and I don't want to, I have to concede, like, because I always try and point to maybe the economic reasons as opposed to purely cultural, because I typically have the view that economy makes culture. So I think your economic situations will create cultures, and those cultures can like escalate and things can be passed down and get worse and worse. But anyway, one of the things it was sort of saying was like a lot of the stuff that's probably we're seeing more now was probably always happening, but there was so much more like in a way segregation. So gentrification was an interesting part of it, because now you're seeing white middle-class people moving into what were previously poor, rough neighborhoods. And so now you're seeing like potentially they're going to be a victim to an attack, and then that becomes newsworthy, and then that's all over the news. And whereas those attacks might have been happening all the time, but we just never saw it because it didn't really affect our bubble. And then you got to think like, and I, this is one I want to look more into, but it's like social housing, even like say the 60s, where compared to now, like murder was lower. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, I read something about how with social housing, I think there was a lot of racial discrimination. So probably white neighborhoods were kind of just kept white neighborhoods, and then sort of like different, like black and ethnic minorities, etc., they were put into different neighborhoods, and they would obviously be poorer. So that's going to sort of, that's the breeding ground for crime, is the poverty and stuff like that. So we're just not seeing it. And then what happened is when we start seeing it more, then it becomes important to us because it affects our lives, and now we talk about it a lot. So I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of this stuff was always kind of happening, but it was all sort of in the sort of fog of non-middle-class culture, and we just weren't really paying that much attention to it. It's hard to know, but I think there is a lot of that potentially.
There's definitely been a history with it within London I can comment on, where one person does a crime and then the entire community is labeled. And I mean, we could talk about the Jewish community during the times of Jack the Ripper. That was definitely an issue. Even when catching Jack the Ripper, that was the issue. There was a guy called Leather Apron who didn't seem like a particularly nice guy, but there was definitely an association with the press. And I think there was something else quite interesting that you brought up, was the media culpability. And I did some research on what they were doing in Glasgow to try and deal with this knife crime, because there's definitely an element of what you were also talking about in your video about consumerism.
Yeah.
And having prestige and having like, being looked at as like an alpha, shall we say?
Yeah,
I think one for a better term, but being looked at as an alpha, as a positive. And in you know, you get that through being hard or being rich or both or other things as well. And one of the things I seem to see was in Glasgow, the community's just had enough and wanted an end to it. And one of the things they got on board with is the media, and trying to calm the media down and not report it as much in order to take it out the press and then get rid of the heat. And it's something that you touched on in your video, that the media exacerbates these things. And I think there is something to be said about that. You know, there's an argument with the shootings in America. Should the media be reporting the name of the culprit? Because part of the reason that they're doing it, we've seen it from the suicide notes, is that they want to go and have their name etched in history forever to, I don't know, make up for the fact that, you know, they've not been popular enough, or they've got mental health issues, or they've been ignored. But interestingly, going back to Jack the Ripper, same problems. Media even caught plagiarizing notes from Jack the Ripper in order to sell papers.
Dude,
and you're
yeah.
like, that doesn't seem to have changed. Because I think you brought up in your video the idea of people in the press creating terms.
Yeah.
So knife crime was one of the points that you made out. And it's almost like, as you said in the video, I'm plugging your video so much today, but it was really good, man. Go on, man.
Yeah, it was when I saw the point you made about crime rates in New York, in London exceeding New York, and then you're like, oh, it's because New York crime rate has come down. And I was like, that's crazy, because I never knew that. Because I knew the story. I was like, wow, I'm not going to London, you know. Especially when you said, yo, run me your pockets, your album dead. I was like, I was just died. I found that so funny. But I was like, you know what? In reality, yeah, if I go to London, I don't want to hear that. Because if I hear that, I'm just like, cool, we're good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's, it sounds like if you go to London, you'll get stabbed.
But in reality, I looked at, because I did a whole bit on trying to, I made the video a lot shorter than it was originally, but I did a whole bit on just explaining that even relative to Europe, we're relatively safe. We are like living in safe countries, but it's just the way the media makes your imagination go crazy. And it's just like, even the thing that really pissed me off when I was thinking about it and going into this video was like, if you hear them say the term, like, I don't know, they're talking about gangsters or a gangster, your image, and I don't think anyone could deny this, their image in their head will be a black guy. And it's like, that's so fucked, because it's so not reality. Like, reality is just, on stats alone, it is way more likely to be a white guy, just because there's more white people in the country. But the fact that our brains are tuned to think of it like that then means that when we come to think about like solutions to this stuff and like helping it, we are already operating from an incorrect perspective, that we see it as like a cultural like a specific thing of multiculturalism or their culture, or like people from this background do this. Yeah. It's our initial like presumption. Yeah. Is that we're operating it from this perspective that it's about culture, and it's so unhelpful, and it becomes so hard to argue people out of that. Because like you said, you heard this one article about London and New York, and why would you challenge that? Because you just think the article is telling the truth or whatever. How many of those fucking articles have we seen that we've just absorbed into our belief system that are bullshit and misrepresentations? And it becomes really hard to then deal with those, the actual reasons, because people don't even believe.
They don't want to believe.
Yeah, they don't believe the truth in it.
You know, we will hopefully talk about Brexit and Labour and the economy and within that and poverty, and it does connect into that. It's more about poverty than anything else. I think Glasgow's the example where it isn't about the culture, it's about the poverty. And what you see, and from what I've researched into what they were doing up there, you know, it's not about a minority group, it's about poverty. And then making sure there are things that are there to get kids out of that situation as much as possible, whether that's extra education, which is a possibility, Saturday classes, or boxing, or football.
Community centres, community centres open. Give them something to do. That's not, you know, there was a guy, I watched that video just quickly, what he would do is he would target people that are like 13, not in a that kind of predatory way, but in terms of, he would try to get him into his gang, and he'd get him to sell drugs, and they'd be like, oh, you see that kid there? He's selling drugs on yourself. You got to deal with him. You got to stab him. And that's what they do, isn't it? So what you have to do is make sure you keep those people away. You know, you lock them up, you find those people who are like effectively grooming kids into gangs. That's what they're doing. And give those kids something to do, an opportunity, a way out where they don't have to go to crime. They don't have to join, you know, what's it called? County lines gangs and things like that to make money. Because that's what's happening. You know, these kids will go home. They'll drop, you know, hundreds of pounds, you know, to their mom or their dad or whoever's at home. And their parents won't question it because they need the money. But if we have a society where you're not, you know, just desperately trying to live, you might say to your kid, like, look, where the hell did you get this from? What's going on?
Yeah.
But then if you're in a, and again, this is going to link into what we were talking about later. If you've got a situation where the economy's shit, and it is, you've got 30% of kids living in poverty, 30% of families living in poverty. I think out of that, I think it's 14% of those families are way below the poverty. They're in extreme poverty, like they're skipping meals.
Mm.
You're going, that's obviously going to help. You've got to have, it's really difficult, because at the same time, you've got to say that people have to take personal responsibility for their actions. Mm. And you hope, and you hear of stories, people getting out of that, like Gordon Ramsay's quite a famous one, like alcoholic dad, but basically he pulled himself out. So there's a level of personal responsibility.
It drives me insane. Sorry.
I was just going to say, like, the poverty exacerbates the situation. And it's really interesting because the Conservatives shut down a lot of these things. And I think they've just got this level of naivety where they think, oh, it didn't hurt me. I didn't have that. So why do you need it? But there's also like an element of, oh, we can save some money here because the crime isn't that bad. But the crime isn't that bad because you've got these things in place. Go on, Jim.
Bro, yeah, that sort of the self-made man shit, like, really just pisses me off in a way, because it's like, it's a Victorian attitude that they told the people in Victorian eras that your life is yours to fix, and if you're not out of your scenario, it's like, basically, it's your fault. And it's so dumb, because, yeah, we point to these people, like, I didn't know that about Gordon Ramsay, but yeah, Gordon Ramsay, and you point to certain people that are able to do it, and the reason they ever do it is because they're fucking exceptional people. Like, you see what they've achieved. They're incredibly different to everyone else. So they were able to do it. But most people, like, the honest truth is just most people are just normal people. And most people will be sort of similar to all the people they're around.
Mm.
And it's like, the amount of wealthy people or rich people I know that are just pretty average. They haven't gone and done anything excellent. They've just sort of survived. They've sort of floated along and done okay. But if that's because your sort of bubble and the people you're around all are at this sort of level, then you're at least, I don't know if it's like genetic or whatever, but the least gifted person will still do well enough. And I've seen some very dumb people do well and like make decent enough money just because, yeah, pretty much their background. But if you then take that scenario down to like a really poor community, it's like you're now thinking like your exceptional person has to now fucking climb here. Whereas when it was middle class, it was like here. And so then if you think that everyone else, they're all down here, and you're probably always going to be the product of the people around you, you're never going to really, like, on average, like, just on average, get out of that. And it's like, to me, it's the most annoying thing about conservatives is that it's such a clear economic argument to deal with poverty. Like, it's so clearly obvious. It costs the economy shitloads. It's like $24 billion a year is wasted on, like, gang crime. It's like $6 billion is for prisoners or stuff like that. It's, like, so expensive. It makes the country more dangerous. It makes people want to go into shops less. It's like an economic argument. If you detach all morality, it economically makes sense to deal with poverty. You're going to maximize your workforce because those people in poverty, if they have slightly more leg up, they're able to be more productive in society and do better jobs. It's like, it's so fucking, to me, it's so such an economic argument. And it blows my mind that they always just talk about lift yourself up and, like, you know, just fix yourself. Like, probably most people aren't going to. Probably most people aren't exceptional. Probably most people are just going to do what everyone else around them does. And that's like, I don't know why we seem to think that everyone needs to be the shining example. It's just by nature of the word exceptional, it's like, it doesn't make sense to think that everyone's going to be exceptional. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, don't. To me, that makes sense. I won't go into too much detail, but my dad came from nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing. And built up what he built up and did well. And you've got this element of the hustle. You've got this element of IQ to him.
Mm.
But the point I find is luck.
Yeah.
They just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And the other people that they needed to connect with happened to be there at the right place at the right time. Yeah. No way you could have planned that. And yet success came. Now, you could argue that they jumped on the opportunity and that's down to their skill.
Mm.
But it wasn't their choice that those people were at the right place at the right time.
Mate. I used to be like such, like, almost just egotistical about the fact that I grew up with a mate and he hasn't done fantastically in life, right? And I used to think, well, we did the same sport together. We had the same sort of thing. I was doing all these things whilst you weren't doing all these things. And then I went and sort of achieved things. And I really sort of looked at it like, well, if I'm able to do it, and I had this such arrogance to it, but I was like, if I'm able to do it, I don't really feel much sympathy for people who aren't able to do it. And I then thought about it and I was like, I was raised by parents who really loved me, who were always there, who let me live in their house until about 23. That period of time, I was able to fuck up, make mistakes, try different things. I tried like 3 different jobs. And then I got to a point where I built up skills from all these fuck ups and then went and got a really cool career being a YouTuber. And then I think I'm just like so gifted. No, the reason being was that my parents gave me such a luxury that majority of society will never even experience. They have to get out the house very quickly.
Mm.
They have to go take whatever job they can do. They don't have the luxury of time and energy that I had for all these years. And so, like, it kind of makes me sick thinking about how I used to perceive other people who hadn't been so successful or something. And I was like, it's so obviously half the reason I've done well is because the fact that my parents helped me. And
and that's luck.
Yeah, and it's your parents. And but you also got to think, like, the more of this luxury time I have of like the 4 or 5 years, the more opportunities of luck I'm going to have because I'm going and seeing different things. I'm learning different things. So my quantity of luck opportunities rises as opposed to the person who has to go and get a job and work at B&Q for, you know. So I'm saying, like,
do you find the same, Madge?
Yeah, I mean, there's an anime I watch where the guy was saying the most important trait on the battlefield is luck. And it's probably the most important trait in real life. There was a really funny thing in school where someone was talking about what traits are important, and someone said luck, and the teacher goes, "No, that's stupid." And then about 10 seconds later, he goes, "Well, you know, I was lucky because I had an interest in history, and that's why I became a teacher." And I'm like, "You fuck. You absolute fucker." My friend was pissed. He was so pissed. And I remember that because I was dying. I was just gone. So yeah, luck is, you know, you still got to take opportunities and stuff, but you got to put yourself in a place like you did to take opportunities. Like in football, like if you're in the 6-yard box, the ball hits you, goes in. You're in the right place, but it's still got to hit you and go in. It's luck at the end of the day. Frank Lampard did that, and then he celebrated, and I was like, "Fuck you," because you deserve that. But that, you know, luck is important, and a lot of people don't have that.
But this was the thing, right? So when I listened to all the sort of Jordan Peterson shit and all the like self-help stuff, it worked for me because I was in a position to be able to utilize that advice. Like, work hard works when you have a lot of luxury of free time. So there's this part of me where on a personal level, I'm probably quite as self-help, self-made, like sort of old school, I guess. Yeah, like you could say conservative in that attitude of like, go do your thing, no one's going to help you, on my personal level because of my life circumstances where I have a lot more luxuries than most people. But then when it comes to zooming out to politics, I realize that is such a stupid way of conducting society, because it just doesn't work. Like, on a personal individual level, yes, you can probably make your life better, but will everyone do it? No. And it's so foolish to think that you can just say that and think that people will get themselves out of gang like crime. You know what I mean? You need to get them to a position where they can take that advice. They're not even anywhere near that position.
And I guess that's what they did in Glasgow. They gave them opportunities and they gave them role models. I think that's the other really important thing for the community to have. I thought, to me, it seems like they're just cop-out hippies. Imagine if you ran a farm, right? And you basically said, "I can't be bothered to put any fertilizer, so I'm going to tell everyone that there's no need to put fertilizer down. I'll just let things grow naturally and see what happens."
Yeah, the best plant will win, mate.
Best plant will win, yeah. Like, can you imagine? Every farmer would look at you as if you were insane.
Yeah.
Like, you have to put some hard work in. And, let's go into the Labour Party a little bit with this. Because obviously, like, we were talking about economics and how that can have an effect on poverty and therefore knife crime or crime in general. Like, the statistics are there to show and support that. What are your thoughts? I'm going to throw this over to Madge. What are your thoughts on how Labour have been doing? I appreciate, and I'm going to put this caveat in, you know, it's now, what, 70 days? So we've got to give them a bit of leeway. But this week did not look particularly good for the optics.
I know Yvette Cooper's trying to talk more about knife crime and, you know, making cities safe and towns safe, because there is also obviously a shoplifting epidemic as well, where a lot of shops are just being robbed by people. And the shop policy, I think, is just don't get involved. If they want to take stuff, just give them it, and, you know, insurance will cover it or whatever. With the conference kind of broader, it's not looking too great, to be honest with you. There's obviously the stuff around the gifts or bribes, sleaze, whatever you want to call it. I think that's really marred the conference quite a lot, and it's kind of stopped them going out their kind of key policies around like workers' rights changes and things. I think the winter fuel allowance is probably one of the biggest misplays I've seen from a political party for a while, because it was dumb. You're not saving much money. So I think overall the conference has been marred by bad decisions, the sleaze kind of stuff, and Starmer being a really incompetent kind of political operator. He's not very slick, he's got no charisma, and he's very bad in interviews. He did an interview with Beth Rigby, and I'm like, "My guy, like, you look incredibly spiteful when you're asked about gifts, and you say, well, Sky News, you know, host these parties that cost thousands of pounds, and they invite me."
Thing, you know, what I would say now is I won't be doing donations for clothes again. There won't be any
concerts,
decorations like that. But
look,
I think that's a matter of judgment for individual. And Beth, I might just gently say, Sky invite us to quite a lot of hospitality events. Your summer party is a great party costing thousands of pounds, and you invite me every year. Presumably you want politicians to continue to come. And, you know, part of that is how politics...
important. What I'm trying to get to, which I think I can see, but perhaps you can't, is that for some people out there, it looks like you were going to do politics differently, and now they're seeing that you're claiming for lots of freebies, and it feels less of a clean break, and to some, a sort of continuity Johnson of getting rich friends to pay for stuff.
Well, I've given you the explanation.
Do you just not accept that? Am I just...
I understand why you're asking questions.
Page.
I understand why you're asking questions. And Of course you're right to ask questions, and because you've asked questions, I've given my explanation about why it is that I don't go in the stands at football now, why it is that I wanted to protect my son in his GCSEs, why it is that, you know, my judgment call has been that when you've invited me to the Sky party costing thousands of pounds every year, I've accepted that invitation and come along.
And you're like, I see what you're trying to do, because you're kind of threatening, saying, well, maybe I won't turn up to these parties, but you look like a twat because you're showing how bad the system is.
I'm going to defend him a little bit, because I think it's still, what, 60, 70 days, you know, compared to what we were dealing with the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
In terms of, like even in the build-up to the election, they were making gaffes that look worse than this. And I'm not saying that the donations are great. And obviously, you could turn around and go, they're legal. I personally wouldn't have liked to have seen that with any politician. If I was running for office, I don't think I'd do it myself and take the donations. But that's easier said than done, because you've got to raise money. And there's probably an element in you going, it's a suit, it's not really influence, what's the big deal? But when you hear, the thing that caught my ear was the £2,000 for, was it three pairs of glasses?
Yeah, to look like Harry Potter. Yeah, to look like Harry Potter, it's awful. Have you seen his glasses? Bro, his fit and his glasses pissed me off, because I'm like, you spent how much? Nah. The thing that annoyed me was there was the Glastonbury tickets that one of the ministers got, and they dropped the digital service tax. So that would have taxed like Google and Amazon billions. And, you know, those tickets cost them about 10K. So I'm like, great investment there, Google. Well done,
wait,
ABC.
So Google paid for the tickets.
Yeah. And then Glastonbury.
And then that just so happened.
We saw that policy ban. That was last year. You have the, you know, the 4 million that was donated by that offshore hedge fund.
Yeah.
One of the people linked to that hedge fund got a job as our climate envoy. And the funny thing is that hedge fund makes money off oil and your climate envoy. Okay. Whatever. And, you know, this is the stuff where, we, like you said, we're 70 days in and this is the stuff coming out. Imagine how bad it's going to look when we get, you know, the PFI contracts, you know, private funded investment. When that contract stuff comes out, how murky it will look. We've got a situation where we've got an independent football regulator. They're legislating for that, right? And you're taking tickets from the FA to go see Taylor Swift. Like, you know, that looks really bad, objectively.
I just feel like everyone, we all kind of knew. I think anyone who maybe is perhaps like sort of left on economics or something like that, everyone knew that this isn't like ideal. This isn't what anyone wanted. That was why, like, obviously the low voter turnout, because no one's excited about it. But I think in our hearts, we all had maybe a little bit of hope that perhaps he's just sort of running a bit of a, just trying to appease everyone kind of campaign.
Yeah.
And then in reality, he'll do the real stuff. But in reality, he hasn't done that. And I think either he's scared to sort of break away from, I guess, yeah, like sort of Tory economic policy or something like that, maybe, to give him benefit of doubt or something. But, or he might just, that might be his worldview. Like, that might be how he thinks the world should operate. And I think we all kind of knew it, like, deep down. Like, everyone said, it's like, it's just a red Tory. And it's like, yeah. I think it was kind of obvious. And it's so sad, because I think the real problem is that I think maybe even lefties were more scared about a Starmer government, because it is like the dying chance at trying to save Britain, if that's how you see the world. But, like, Starmer was like, look, Labour voters were like, we never get in. We've got Starmer. And if he fucks up right now, when Conservatives have just absolutely crumbled and now Reform are surging, we can see the obvious outcome is you disillusion everyone from left-wing politics. Conservatives already wrote themselves off, so everyone will just go towards Reform and will become way more sort of further right. And that was the fear. And I think the left that were probably maybe more scared of that, because they can see how populism will rise just after a failed Labour government. Because then they'll be like, well, look, the left don't do anything better anyway, so let's just try the most radical guy.
But no, that's pretty much it. You know, I think you got to see major reform, or people are going to go towards reform. Yeah. That's the problem. So I agree with that. I think the positives I've seen is she's talking about Reeves is talking about tweaking the fiscal rules. So essentially kind of the way debt is calculated will change, and that frees up money. That would be good, like tremendously good. But I've not seen much to be positive about. And I agree with what you were saying about people wanted Labour to do well. You know, my bar for Labour isn't the Tories. Fuck them. They're the worst people going. Do you know what I mean? My bar for Labour will always be people like Clement Attlee, who did shit. Like, he's got a fucking statue for a reason. You know, like, his legacy lives on. It's nearly been, probably near the 80-year mark or whatever. His legacy's still here.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? That's what I want to see. That's my bar for a Labour government, to actually try and do shit. He didn't get everything done. You know, NHS doesn't cover dental and eye care.
Nope.
But I'll fucking take it over this. Do you know what
Yeah,
I mean?
and
Like,
it's just there's no fight in Starmer. Yeah. It should have been more like, no, fuck it. This is what we believe. It shouldn't just be like, look, we get that you guys think this, so we're going to say, like, we sort of think some of that, but we actually think we should help people a little bit more. It should be like, no, we think you're fundamentally ideologically wrong. We don't believe in your core values, your core beliefs on economics, and we believe it should be more like this, and we'll try this, and if this doesn't work, then fine, we're wrong, but we think it's different. But they're just trying to sell to everyone, because obviously they were scared, because Labour fucked themselves with Jeremy Corbyn, like, in terms of the way they were perceived by, like, a lot of centrists. So he's so scared to do that that he's now, like, bound himself, I think, and so he's unable to, like, actually do what he probably wants to, or what everyone wants him to do. I don't know. That's me, maybe I'm being optimistic.
I don't know if I'm gonna play devil's advocate here, but I'm gonna say there are two, three things that are issues with whatever policy he takes. So I mean, a couple of the policies I thought he could do, even just for a year, he could have done a millionaire's tax for 1 year, and that would have staved off a lot of the problems of, like, the winter fuel payment. He could have said for 1 year, anyone earning over 100,000, you don't get your free £12,570 tax exemption. And that would have raised just enough money probably to stave off doing the winter fuel allowance if he really needed to do it for a year or two, which then would have given the pensioners time to prep. But it also would have meant that he could have come up with a better solution and get the economy a little bit more on track. But the three problems he's got the media, which we've all discussed, which are just basically profit driven to such an extent that, you know, we've just talked about knife crime and the influence they're having on that in order to sell newspapers. But there's also an issue with the fact that they're predominantly center right. You've got a lot of influencers out there as well on YouTube. I did a video on Konstantin Rishon this week. He was on Stephen Bartlett's show, DOAC.
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, the stuff he was coming out with was just wild and inaccurate. And I basically did, you know, he did a 2-hour chat with Stephen, and I ripped into it for half an hour, and I don't normally make videos like that. But the stuff that he came out with, his solutions, and it was very similar to this neoliberal stuff. He can purport these ideas and people will listen. I think Brexit's an issue. Is it possible for us to just go straight to the EU after everything that's happened over the last 5 years and get us straight back in? I think there's a good chance. And I think also just announcing it would increase the pound, which would help with import prices. Even announcing it. But the other thing is, FDI, foreign direct investment, it's down 30%. That's huge. And exports aren't doing any good, and we'll bring in Brexit. But if he puts in some of these things, let's say increasing corporation tax, just as an example, there's others he could have done. If he brought in corporation tax, that could put off more investment. So what does he do? You're stuck in a rock and a hard place. And then that comes up with this conservative ideology. We'll just work on the economy. I'm not agreeing with it. I'm just saying I am playing a bit of a devil's advocate and coming to his rescue because YouTube have absolutely ripped into it.
Yeah, with the corporation tax.
it's good to have a debate on these things.
Sure. With the corporation tax, I think Sunak's own analysis at the Treasury was saying, like, cutting corporation tax doesn't bring in necessarily more investment. The one I would really want to see, and Rachel Reeves, she talked about doing it and then she kind of backtracked on it, was matching capital gains tax and income tax. That's the one where I'm not going to give him a ton of credit because I think it's basic, but if she does that this year, I'll fucking take it. And the only problem with that one is you can't announce it too early because people start messing with how they deal with their funds, you know, like their accountancy and stuff. But I will take that one. That one's an easy win. I think the public will love that one as well. So if she does that one, I'll give her some credit for it, even though it's basic. But there's not much hope for that budget coming up. You know, the problem is, like, they keep talking about how it's going to be painful and all this stuff, and all these companies are looking at it like, cool, I'm going to go set up in Spain or somewhere else, because why would I set up where you are? And so, you know, there was a Bloomberg piece out today talking about how Labour's kind of talk around gloom is having a depressing effect on the economy. I think the guy in charge of Iceland said a similar thing. And so that's why you're seeing a backtrack of him saying, well, there's light at the end of the tunnel. It's like, the only time you say there's light at the end of the tunnel is when you're going to die.
Don't go into the light.
So, you know, I'm just saying, you know, don't go into there's a Harry Potter meme I love with the guy from Twilight where he goes, don't go into the twilight. Sorry, I love it. It's honestly like my brain is half memes most days.
But that's all you need, mate.
Twilight. Yeah, honestly, it's the only way to cope nowadays, but yeah, don't go into the twilight. So I don't know what
I was listening to this podcast. You guys, do you listen to Destiny, you know, the American?
Yeah, I know Destiny.
He now has a podcast called, like, Bridges Podcast, and he did this one with this economist, like, quite a young yeah, quite a young lady economist, and I don't know her full credentials or whatever, but she was talking about this thing like the vibes economy, and she was saying how there is a massive thing around how people feel that, like, versus reality. So they might actually have more money, but if they feel negative about the future of the country because of the way we're talking about it, it does affect how people use, potentially affects how they spend and use their money. But yeah, I don't know too much about it, but it was just I was thinking from what you were saying.
It's kind of true, to be fair. But, you know, the way she phrased it is quite Zoomer.
Yeah, well, she's proper Zoomer, mate.
A Zoomer is a term used to describe someone from Generation Z, typically born between the late 1990s and the early 2000s. It's a playful spin on the term Boomer for baby boomers and refers to the generation that grew up with the internet, social media, smartphones and other digital technology.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. But it's kind of like, you know, if you hear the economy's going to do bad and you're thinking, you know, I might buy a new car or whatever. I don't want to do that just in case I lose my job or something like that. But if you think the economy's doing well, you think you're personally doing well, you think, I might, you know, go for a house renovation or maybe I'll go out more to eat or whatever. I'll start spending more. Whereas if you think we're going into a downturn, if you keep thinking, you know, it's going to be painful or whatever, maybe I don't get a pay increase this year, you kind of cut back. So they are right. Yeah. You know, the vibes economy is one I don't think I'll ever say. I think I'm too
I'm
old
sure there's a better word. I'm sure there's
yeah, it's confidence. It's just confidence in the economy, to be honest. I think that's probably the way to say it. But the vibes economy is something I'm too old man to
You've accepted it. Yeah, I still try.
I'm in my old man arc, bro. I'm too old for this stuff. I'm done. But no, it does make sense. What she says makes sense. It's just for a certain audience to understand it. But it's just about confidence in the economy, which is true.
FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the first thing he did was a speech to get confidence in people and putting money in the back into the banks, and that's the 1930s.
Do you see America's recovering as well? Their economy is actually doing really well because Biden invested like a ton of money into it, and that's how you get foreign direct investment. You can say to companies like, look, we'll give you a subsidy if you set up shop here and you manufacture the stuff here, and it does help.
This is what she was getting at. She was like, look, a lot of the stuff that the Biden campaign has actually done has done some benefit to our economy, but people don't feel like it. And they don't. And even if the facts are different than reality. And that was, it was kind of interesting because it was like, you're right. They've done some stuff that seems to be doing some benefit.
And they got higher growth than China.
China were talking about investing more in their economy as well. I think in America, you just keep the their fuel prices low and everyone's happy. I swear to God, I've never seen a group of people get so mad around petrol prices. They're just like, it's gone up by like 50 cents. And I'm just like, bro, if you lived in England, you would not move, fam. You've seen our petrol prices.
So what do you think about all the, like, the GB energy stuff? Are you like optimistic on that? Because that was like one of the things I was like, that's cool on like a sort of like in the way that the sovereign wealth fund kind of thing, like how the Nordic countries do it. Everyone goes, well, it's because they have a load of fuel and they're fuel independent. But like, it's so deeply important because if you have control of your own energy supply, that's a fucking amazing thing. Yeah. And just think how different your geopolitics becomes when you're not so dependent on, you know, tyrannical regimes over fuel.
With GB Energy, it depends because they've called it an energy company that's going to own assets. But in another interview, Starmer said it's an investment vehicle. So it might not own assets, but it might just manage or whatever. And I'm like, I need to know the details. And they haven't put out a ton of details yet. And so I'm kind of not... The problem is, okay, say they build a load of wind turbines, right, off the coast of Scotland or wherever, right? Is that energy going to be sold on the international market and you use that money to, you know, maybe cut people's bills via direct funding or like an energy price cap? Or I don't know how it's going to work. In theory, it's a great idea because there's loads of offshore wind you can build in, you know, in the UK, in around us. We're an island and it's windy as hell. I know, trust me, I see it most days in the winter. But it depends on what you do. So, you know, it's like, you know, Sunak, he spent $38 billion on test and trace, right?
Yep.
The biggest waste of money I've ever seen. If you invested that money in the economy into, say, a GB Energy, right? Imagine how many wind turbines you could build, the job creation, all of that kind of stuff. So it depends. You know, like GB Energy, we've got to see the details, really, because, you know, like, it could be
nice.
Great. It sounds nice, and it did poll really well. Yeah. But if it doesn't do much, like if it doesn't own assets, it's not pointless, but it's more like a marketing thing more than anything.
So it'd
be worth keeping an eye on, to be honest. I'm going to try to, but we need to wait and see on that one. That one I'll give time for.
Yeah.
I'd like to see fusion. That's the thing, but it's still 25 years away.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, it's getting better. There's no arguing about that. They keep breaking records and how long they can sustain the fusion electromagnetic field around the reaction. So I think China's got it up to like 30 seconds, which is huge.
Like, that's a massive leap. Plus, you've got AI coming in. It's probably going to be able to help to a certain extent with the calculations and
we're going
to
build Ultron before we get proper energy sufficiency.
Well, no, we're not. I mean, that's a great little segue for us because they cut the funding for the Edinburgh supercomputer, haven't they? But they've kept the free ports open, which is costing us about $10 billion a year, I think, according to the Financial Times.
That was well done.
Benefit.
That was really well done. I'll give you that one. But no, yeah, with the free ports, I always thought it was a bad idea. I thought it would actually not succeed, but I think I always thought people would invest in it. The problem with the free ports is that whatever goes in there when it comes out, it's going to get taxed. So it's kind of stupid. And whatever, you know, comes into Britain will get taxed, and whatever goes out will be taxed. And
can you explain the free ports to me? Sorry.
So it's like a area where they have lower regulations, lower taxes. And effectively it's like it's almost like a city within itself or like a port within itself. And so normally they're used for money laundering or you know, like port, you sell, you know, art. So you go there with art pieces or whatever, you'll sell it to someone and you say you launder cash. It's a good way to do it. Yeah. That's why Cameron closed them. So we never had to leave the EU to have them. It's ironically David Cameron that closed them, and we could have opened more without Brexit anyways. But the problem is in trade deals, they don't include them. So like, say for example, we had a deal with France, with Canada, right? So you deal with Canada, you build all your stuff in your free port, low regulation, low tax, whatever, and you try and sell it into Canada. Canada can say, look, yeah, you can't do that because it's unfair, because we have higher standards than you. So all of that stuff coming in will be marked as from a free port and it'd face various taxes and other things. They might just ban it outright, but it's not, it's almost like, it's like not part of the country, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's really weird because we have something called charter cities, which are basically the same thing, but not around ports. Yeah. And it's the same principle, which Liz Truss pushed a lot. And I don't know how many of those we actually have in England. It's actually terrifying because it's the same principle, but it's almost like you have a governor that deals with stuff. And it's like a law within itself. It's nuts, bro, honestly. Like, it's so kind of empire, the age of empire, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What's it called? The East Indian Tea Company.
Yeah,
is that
yeah.
One? It's kind of
it
like
sounds
that.
I mean, like, literally the formation of London was that it was like an exemption from all the rules and they had their own I feel like from I guess a zoomed out perspective, I think the thing in England at the moment, I just think ideologically we need to be able to like sort of shift people's attitudes towards taxes and public investment. I think that's the thing I've noticed, is that there's just such this attitude, like, kind of looping it back to knife crime and stuff, like is there such an attitude of not spending money? So, like, we can fix the knife crime problem or we can massively help it, but it costs money. And we have become so, like, this is that neoliberal thing where we just ideologically, the idea of massive investment into things is now seen as, like, there's such deep distrust in the government's ability to run businesses and operate things efficiently or effectively. And we've just sort of, I think we've all absorbed this attitude that the government can't do it properly, and in Britain we don't do much public spending. We've just accepted that.
Apart from, like, the NHS, which we all love.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, but you'll hear from the right that the management fees are over the top. Too many admins, but not enough nurses. But if you compare it to the States and other countries, I think Australia and about, I don't know, four other examples, we spend less on management. But the media, again, just go off on the rails and just, obviously, it's like a group of people that say, like, Michael Gove's just been put in charge as the editor of The Spectator.
Yeah,
like, I mean, like, the guy is absolutely balmy and back Brexit. And The Spectator's like, yeah, we'll have that guy.
I mean, he makes sense as a pick, to be fair. They had Andrew Neil not long ago. I think, you know, with public investment, I think there's polling to say people are happy to spend more in taxes if they know where it's going.
Yeah.
And so if that money actually goes into the NHS and they feel the benefit, like, they can actually get GP appointments, or if you get that A&E 4-hour target, I think people will notice it a lot more.
I think that's how you build that confidence back up, just in sort of general government. Because, yeah, that was the main thing. Like, what I was going to say is, like, with the knife crime thing, right, it's this sort of double problem where, when you're in a time of, like, economic, I don't know if you say we're in economic downturn, but, like, we're obviously not doing super prosperously. And we're
stagnation.
Stagnation, yes.
Yeah.
When you're in that period of time, it's the most important to spend and, like, work on these things, but it's so unpopular because whatever you choose becomes, like, so say you want to fix the knife crime thing, you then go, right, we're going to spend, I don't know, 7 billion on fixing knife crime. And then people will go, you mean you're going to give those people who are running around in the streets with knives 7 billion pounds? Yeah. And then you're like, well, yeah, but they wouldn't run around the streets with the knives if we give them the money. But they're like, no, we can't reward these people. These people are animals. They deserve to go to jail, which will cost us more money that we have to spend, but it doesn't fix it. And it's,
do you know what's nuts? Yeah, sorry. In the video you put out, The guy was saying it costs like $1 million or something like that for a criminal trial. And I was like, fucking hell. And he was like, yeah, imagine you gave that out to people. And I was like, I think that's what you got to do, man. You got to, like, the way you did it in that video, I think it was really good. Explain to people the cost of inaction, like the cost of getting rid of the winter fuel allowance. An ambulance call out costs £250. Your winter fuel allowance is like £300. So you're not, you know, if any of those people need an ambulance,
Yeah,
you've
that's such a
lost.
good argument. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, hospital bed, staff, discharge papers, you need admin staff. It costs more to do, let it costs more not to do the winter fuel allowance. You know, it costs more to not do, you know, it costs more to keep the two-child benefit cap. You know, as you know, because there's a social cost and an economic cost. And that's the thing, like, you know, like domestic violence, I did a video on it a couple of years ago. It costs more to keep the current system of, you know, allowing, essentially, effectively allowing domestic violence than it is to solve it. Like, the amount of cost for broken bones, for psychological care is insane. Whereas if you build more kind of, you know, refuges for men and women who are victims of domestic crime, domestic violence, and you get them out of there, you actually save money because the
Oh
trials are less complex as well. It's
yeah.
nuts, isn't it? When you put it like that to people, I think you say there's a cost of inaction. Like, I did a video, sorry, I'm plugging loads of videos here. A video on an economist saying that there is a cost of inaction here. And that's what it is. Like, austerity is a
That's a
cost of
good
inaction.
talking point, is cost of inaction. I think that's a really strong way, because what I read this really cool book by Georges Monbiot about neoliberalism, and I really just sort of got this perspective that it's literally like storytelling, and their story is so strong, like the idea of this overburdened, lazy, bureaucratic government that's trying to stifle the little guy making his business. And it's such good, like, rhetoric and stuff, like what you just said there, the cost of inaction is a really good way. Like, that's what I sort of try and think about. It's like, I think having this more kind of, yeah, left economic attitude, it needs better rhetoric, and it needs to be able to not do what Starmer's doing, which is like, look, guys, we want to do just slightly move it over there. It needs to, like, attack it head on and be like, no, you guys are stupid. Your ideas don't work. Look at the world and look at how what your ideology is playing out to create. It doesn't work, and we need to actually argue that. But no one, I well, there are people, but there just doesn't seem to be lots of people tackling it head on like that. Yeah.
The press do kind of limit the people they have on, like the fact that Farage
Yeah.
had, you know, a season pass on Question Time and things, and you don't see
Yeah.
real, like, you see sometimes more journalists than you do see academics on
Yeah.
panel shows and things. That's one of the major problems. Like, it's a big deal when they have like an actual good economist on Question Time, and then you see clips from it and you're like, oh wow, I can actually cover this stuff, versus someone who's an author and says, well, I think, you know, the real problem with Starmer is, and they'll put like, you know, his speech or some shit, and you're just like, bro, that's not the big deal. Like,
Yeah.
the pol it's the policies that are the important thing.
On that
Yeah.
note,
No,
Jimmy,
this was so much fun.
Madge, thank you so much. Check out their links in the description. Guys, thank you. Like, subscribe. Bye.
Be sure to tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.